The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, well, I know we're competing with Louis Marcos, and if they didn't slot me for this time, that's where I would be. So if you have not heard Louis Marcos, he's a phenomenal, fantastic speaker. I have learned so much from him. Major sections of my curriculum have come from him, and I'll get to that as we sequence it. So two questions are on the board, okay? Bell work, right? So what are your thoughts? How is your biology class connected to the curriculum of the rest of your school? This is where I ask and you answer. Or is it a very simple answer? It doesn't. Mine wasn't for a very long time. I guess I should introduce myself a bit more. I'm Robbie Andreessen. I teach at the Geneva School in Orlando, Florida. I just finished my 11th year. And we were even just talking up here about, you know, new hire comes in, not a whole lot of classical background. And it takes a lot of work for us in the science department to get a real answer to the first question. There's the science department, there's the humanities department, and my belief is that it really is incumbent upon us in the science department to build enough of a bridge over to the humanities that there can be some real interconnections there. And it doesn't have to be a four-lane highway, okay? It just has to be enough for some, I think, real powerful connections to be made. When I started teaching at Geneva 11 years ago, I didn't even know that history could be divided into categories. Seriously, I found, you've got ancient Near East, Greece, Rome, Middle Ages, modern time period? That's genius! Who developed that? That's so helpful! Honestly, that's where I was 11 years ago. So it has taken a lot of reading, a lot of conversations, a lot of work to build real connections with the rest of my colleagues. Does anybody feel like they have something that a real connection that they've made in terms of biology class? Yes. Okay. Yes. And you do this through with a biology class, or okay, very cool. All right. So I have a historical narrative as well, and we'll see how ours compare. That'd be cool. What tensions do you experience? Anybody else on the first question? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, excellent. Excellent, excellent. So do we. Very good. So art and science. What is the skill that connects both art and science? Observation. You can't draw well unless you can observe. And you can't do science well unless you can observe. We have, I guess I should dig it out now. I have a register of effects that you may have seen from pre-conference or from Robbie Jane's class, where they do drawings and they put all things together. This is actually mine from my first attempt a couple of years ago. But this is a summary of their whole biology year, all kind of rolled up into one. And this is primarily what they used to study for their final exam. But we'll get to that in a minute. What tensions do you experience when teaching creation and evolution? We're all in different parts of the country, different students, different parents coming from different backgrounds. Any particular tensions or issues that arise for you? Yeah. Nope. Yep. Okay. Do you guys think evolution creation is still a huge, big issue? You do? No? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Okay. So what she was saying up here is that it's kind of morphed into a different kind of discussion, a theistic evolution versus not. I didn't have this year's class. There were some students whose interest was piqued by the conversation, but I haven't had in the last couple of years anyone highly animated about it. And this is my own reflection at the moment. Seems like so many of the issues that are driving things in our culture, from homosexuality to transhumanism to robots to all kinds of things, all center around how do we view our own body. And I'm wondering if that is a big topic we need to be having more conversations about. How do we have a good theology of the body or way of thinking about our embodiment that would help provide answers to some of those issues? I'm really just sort of speculating on that point. Oh, a couple of warnings about me. I get really excited about these things, and so with excitement tends to come speed, and so if I start going through things kind of quickly and you miss something, please don't hesitate to raise your hand and say, could you say that again, or could you elaborate that, or poke the person next to you and have them raise their hand if you're too shy to raise your hand. Okay? So it's the end of the day, almost the end of the day, but still, I'm stoked, ready to go. Here we go. Biology curriculum, first quarter. I introduce these three historical philosophical threads. There's a whole historical framework to my year. The first and second quarter are humans, animals, and plants. Before the invention of the microscope, that's all we knew. We start the second semester with the microscope, microbiological life. We continue the historical narrative to Darwin. And so it's basically, very briefly, a macrobiology to microbiology approach. Okay? Big picture, macro to micro. But I have these terms. Which one's my laser button? There we go. Natural history, natural science, natural philosophy. Natural history. What is it? Is the question. All right? And so the first quarter we talk about the human body. The second quarter we talk about animals and plants. What are these things? What are their characteristics? And this book is called A Register of Effects. We are taking note of all the various effects, things that we see in the living world, and we're providing a summary of them. Natural science is what is the cause of these effects? All right? And so we play on this word cause, and I'm looking to use this word a lot more, particularly in this coming year, as I've experimented with things last year. Natural philosophy is, how do these two relate to each other? How are they situated in reality? So can the cause actually account for the effects? Okay? And so you look at the effects, you think about the cause, and you go back and forth between them. You're doing natural philosophy. This is where theology can come in and inform. This is where student experience is important, is the going back and forth between natural history and natural science. So the big issue in terms of cause and framing what we mean by cause is when we get to Darwin's theory of evolution. Okay? Is the theory of evolution, is the Darwinian theory of evolution, or the neo-Darwinian synthesis, are these satisfactory causes to account for the effects that we see? And so I have a listing of effects. Students are drawing body systems. They're talking about parts, purpose, and interconnections. They're drawing animals. They're talking about their parts, and on and on and on and on and on throughout biology. And these are effects. Okay, so can this cause natural selection on random mutations over a long period of time? Is that a sufficient cause to account for the things we see? And I use this language of cause and effect throughout the year. All right, so first quarter, my big topic, my big piece of wisdom I'm trying to pass on to my students, everything is interconnected. What does modern education do? It dissects, it fragments, it shatters into a bazillion pieces, and there is no connection between English and biology class. There is no connection between history and physics class. They are separate, independent disciplines. Well, no, that's not true. Everything is interconnected. And so I have, we go through the human body in my first quarter. One of the reasons I do the human body, it's because it's that part of biology I'm the most excited about, okay? Which is why I give you this big framework of macro to micro. If you are stoked about plants, ferns just get your heartbeat going, then start with plants. I would never do that. No offense to the botanists in the room, okay? I just don't get that big a rise out of doing plants. They're important. I appreciate photosynthesis. I love to eat. But I'm much more, because of my own background, I'm much more at home talking about the human body than I am talking about plants. And so what I'm the most passionate about, there's a greater chance I'm going to instill some passion into my students. Okay? So don't think of, this is the way you must do it. No, I'm trying to give you a model for how it can be done with some ways of thinking how to modify it for yourself. All right, so I go through systems, and I have a big integrating question at the end of the quarter. Okay, it's a one-question essay, and we're preparing for it the whole quarter. Okay, the question is, you eat a ham, cheese, lettuce, tomato, mayo, mustard sandwich. How does that affect every system of your body? Simple. Now, what this question gives me is a goal so that when I'm thinking about all the material I could teach, I think, does this piece of information help get my students to that goal? If it's more tangential, I can drop it. Okay? It helps me to think of systems in very, you know, pared down, easy ways. We have control systems. We have our nervous system. We have our endocrine system. We have our circulatory system, whose goal is transportation. And we have another transportation system, the lymphatic system, which works in conjunction with circulatory. But every time I go to a new system, I talk about, all right, so I start with the nervous system. You could start with the skeletal system. There's some better starting points than others. I would never start with the lymphatic system. That doesn't make sense. But if you wanted to start with skeletal system, the next logical system to add would be the muscles, right? And then from there, okay, so if you've got skeletal muscles, you also have cardiac muscles and smooth muscles. So with cardiac muscles, you could link to circulatory system, or with smooth muscles, you could link to digestive system. All right, and then you just kind of link them together. And so as students are growing in knowledge, they're seeing how all these parts interconnect. And I tell them all the time, everything's interconnected. Yeah. Ninth grade biology. And part of the beauty of starting with the human body with ninth graders is that the worldview of a ninth grader doesn't extend much further than their nose, right? And they're always interested in how their body works. Okay, so I get through maybe four or five systems, time for a test. It's your regular multiple choice, matching, true, false kind of, I don't do true, false, but matching kind of questions. I go through all the rest of the systems. I will do a rat dissection where they see all of these systems in a mammalian context, and they have to be able to identify the parts. What bone goes here? What is this organ? Very much connected to all the information they've gotten before. And then after that, we spend some time synthesizing and, you know, continuing to synthesize and bring things together, and then they'll have their sandwich question. When I've had block days or have been able to do tests on block days, I'll give them the whole time period. Sometimes I don't have the block day available to me, and like, all right, look, you got 45 minutes. you're going to have to figure out how to talk about all 11 systems, parts, purpose, and how they interconnect. So you're going to have to sit and think through this and really have it well in mind so you can sit and you can write. Does that make sense? So having an integrative question or something like that is very helpful to answering the question, what do I teach? I can't teach it all. But if you have something that helps to integrate things together, now you can see that not all facts have the same value. Not what Steve Turley was talking about, fact-value split. I'm talking about what do I need to teach versus not. Does that make sense? All right. Let me play on this word cause just a little bit. When you think of Aristotle and you think of the word cause, what are the words that come to mind? Not so much first cause, but formal cause, final cause, material cause, efficient cause. All right? So a lot of what we talk about with systems interacting with each other, we're talking about material cause. We're talking about efficient cause. So the cardiac muscle contracts, relaxes, contracts, relaxes, blood flows. But why are you one thing? Why can I look at you as a human being with all of these parts and far more than we ever talked about? Why do you consider yourself one thing? What is the cause of your unity? Does modern science have a real answer for that? Not really. We just kind of are. Well, the ancients have an answer. That would be their form. It's an immaterial reality that binds together the parts to make you your one thing. So our formal cause would be our soul. We are God's image. Hey, there's a natural telos to development, right? All of these ninth graders are going to turn into human adults, human beings of older age, adults, we'll see, hopefully, by the 35. But that's like their physical telos. They're going to develop that. They can't help but do that. But there's an ultimate telos, right? And that's to see the glory and beauty of God and be filled with the love that moves the sun and the stars. That's one of my ties into Dante. All right, so I talk about, so what makes the most sense? So we can, if we're trying to account for how we function as human beings, oh, and by the way, we act with desire and purpose, don't we? Right? Atoms and molecules, is there any way of talking about purpose with just if there's just atoms and molecules? Not really, but it's purpose and desire are obvious in living things, particularly in ourselves. What accounts for that? What accounts for the meaningfulness of our lives if it's just atoms and molecules? So I'm going to do this compare and contrast between what makes the most sense to understand ourselves, four causes or two causes. Does that kind of make sense? All right, so second quarter. Anyone here for the pre-conference? Several of you? This is when I do the taxonomy demonstration, where I talk about the taxonomy system that we would teach of domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, that did not drop out of the sky, okay? Our science textbooks were not delivered from on high. They developed because of questions and issues, and I want them to see that. Yes, we have an organizational system for all living things, but that organizational system, it was just one of many that values different things. Aristotle, all the way through up until its final death in the 18th and 19th century, great chain of being, this linear sequence of living things where there's man through the animals, the plants, the minerals, and then from man up to God is all the angelic hosts. God, this is how God organized things. This is the hierarchy. If you're teaching with, and if your history, you know, counterpart in your grade is doing the Middle Ages, oh, they'll be all over this great chain of being. This is why people live where they are and why they were stuck there. There's all this concept of great chain of being. But then the Voyages of Discovery come along and whammo, here's all these new creatures. What in the world do we do with them? And so people had different systems to try to organize them. And Linnaeus goes, wait, hold on, guys. We can't even talk with each other if you're using this system and I'm using this system and they're using that system. Let's look. God made this great chain of being. But there's way more creatures than we anticipate. So let's just use this kind of group within group system. And once we've found everything, then we can go and figure out what this sequence is. Okay. One of the creatures I put into my lab for teasing this out is a little creature called a hydra. Anybody know what a hydra is? They really thought for a while that this little creature, this little, what we call an Cnidarian, was the in-between creature for the plants and the animals. All right? So they had this underlying cause. God created this great chain of being. Now we have found the link between plants and animals. All right? So, but this is where underlying ideas shape how we think about things. All right? Our modern taxonomic system highly values the embryonic stages. You know, with like seventh graders, I would do animals are divided up into vertebrates and invertebrates. That's just a really helpful way to make it through life. But is that our modern system? No. We've got phylum. What phylum is that? Anyone know? Chordata? Okay. Because we get these two gimpy little creatures, the lancelet and the tunicate, that have the same embryological development as all the vertebrates. This postanal tail and dorsal hollow nerve cord and all these things that students are going, why in the world are we doing this? Because right now, our system values the embryological. Aristotle didn't care about that. It's not that he didn't care, but there was a telos to the creature, which was the adult. So you look at the adult form, and then you categorize it. We value the embryonic. He valued the adult form. Is ours inherently better than theirs? No, not really. This is just the way we do it. Kind of diminishes that whole science has said. Okay? So then I spend... So we go through this whole thing. Linnaeus has his group within group system. We're all on board with that. But then, in the beginning of the 19th century... Georges Cuvier comes along, totally destroys great chain of being. He categorizes things in ways such that this is done. Great chain of being is dead. Nails in the coffin, never to come back. So now we have this window of time. We have a group within group system with no underlying cause. We have these effects, no underlying cause. Until when? 1859 with Darwin and his publication of Origin of Species. Because there he says, ah, here's why we can categorize things the way we do. It's descent from a common ancestor. Boom, lights go off. Oh, that has to be true. Then you combine that with the embryological biogeography, homologous structures that Cuvier highlighted, and Look at all these effects. This cause makes sense. Boom. Evolution is taking hold of how all of biology is seen. So when we do animals, I talk about it in the modern taxonomic categories. They need to know the names, kind of why they're in there. But I also talk about their life processes. So we talked about the human body and their systems, but all animals have to do these processes of bringing in food, circulation, movement, responding to the environment. And so how do these major categories throughout the animal kingdom handle that? So mammals have a four-chambered heart, birds have a four-chambered heart, reptiles have a three-chambered heart, unless it's the alligators and the crocodiles, but there's a septum, there's a little wall between the fourth, that bottom chamber. Amphibians have a three-chambered heart with no septum. Fish have a two-chambered heart. You know, they all have to do circulation, but they're going to do it a little differently. Okay? So the threads that I have weaving through this section here, particularly on the animals, is their taxonomy. Why are they organized the way they are? And then how does each group it's in handle life processes? Then you get to the invertebrates, and a lot of the answer is diffusion, 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 diffusion. But then I ask the question, what makes the most sense of this? Four causes or two? Why is it we can recognize this creature as a frog? Well, we put the parts together, we just kind of know. Well, there's a cause for that, according to Aristotle, and that is because we recognize its form. There's something immaterial about it that we as a species, we as human beings, can recognize. Tadpoles develop into frogs. They're not going to develop into snakes. There's a telos there. Okay? So this is my first semester. Any questions so far? Yeah. Yes, 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 yes. So we are all used to the material and efficient causes. It's stuff and it's in motion. But the idea that there's an immaterial reality that holds the parts together, we have a hard time getting our heads wrapped around that. The fact that, the idea that things operate with purpose and intention, a telos, you know, we don't think about those terms. Why is the frog jumping after the bug? Oh, we can't ask that question. You know, well, it's because it wants to eat. It's okay, we can say that. There is real purpose and desire put into living creatures. All right, so we're on to the third quarter. This is when I get to the diversity of microscopic life. I'll do a microbiology lab where they'll do a motility test and Gram stain and teach them how to do those kinds of things. Pond lab. One of the things I always do with pond lab and looking for protists, all the students, when they find something, they get super excited. Oh, wow, look at this. This is so cool. But I remind them, you knew they were there. You have known, since you have memory, that there are living things smaller than your eye can see. You have known that. Can you imagine what people felt like when they're realizing there is a whole world of living things that they had no idea about? Where do all these things fit in? What do we do with them? Then I go through the story, Scientific Revolution to 1859, because there are three predominant worldviews, a Platonic worldview or an Aristotelian worldview, a mechanistic worldview, that have existed since the ancient Greeks. Okay. Platonic worldview was dominant through the early church years. Aristotle comes back in. He becomes kind of the dominant worldview. Mechanism lies kind of under the current, under the surface, until the Scientific Revolution. And you can talk with your history and philosophy guys to help you help unpack for you what was happening in the late Middle Ages into the Scientific Revolution in terms of theological shifts, theological changes. This is where Francis Bacon comes in. This is where Rene Descartes comes in. And ultimately, by Isaac Newton, the world is a big machine. How do we view the world? How did God make the world? He made it like a big machine. What are living creatures? They're really complicated machines, meat machines. And this is where formal and final cause start dying away. The problem is living things. Really hard to think of living things as machines. Okay, this is where I would take two students' watches and put them together and say, let's see if they make watch babies. And they all go, hey, are they going to make watch babies? No, they're not. So is life as a machine the best way to think about it? But that's what happened. And can't really understand how life is a machine, can't really understand how species are created until when? Charles Darwin. This is why Darwin is such an important figure in the history of thought. Darwin completes the mechanistic model. The mechanistic model that started with Bacon and Francis Bacon and Rene Descartes, culminating, and Isaac Newton, the world's a great machine, made by God. God's the great engineer. Okay? But as God becomes the hypothesis that's no longer necessary, oh, except for living things. It's in the living world. This is Paley, right? Look at the living world. See how intricate and complicated it is. God must have done that. Until Darwin comes along and says, oh, no, I got a mechanism where God's not necessary. So now there are only two causes. And since 1859... this is just the way, the mentality of our world. All right. So when I talk about evolution, I talk about it in Darwin's own context. I talk about it in the context of what they understood in 1859. And with the evidence that they had and with what he was proposing and with God being a deist, God made this great machine, he stepped back. Not too hard for people to, mechanism just put it all together. God's not that necessary anymore. Except for, meaning in life, personal fire insurance, if there's an afterlife, being good, okay? So that's how I approach teaching evolution, so that I can teach it in a very strong form, but saying, guys, look, the story's not over yet. There's lots of other pieces to this, like how does God interact with his creation? How does he relate to it? Is he like a great engineer where he got it started and has stepped back, which is where evolutionary creationists come in? That would be their view. Or does God put his hands into creation, do things, and how does providence work like that? Everyone believes in providence, but how that functions is different. And there's still a lot more effects we have to look at before we pass some judgment up. But I want them to feel the weight of the argument. Why is it published in 1859 and then by 1875, if you don't believe in descent from a common ancestor, you're not publishing in the science world? How did that happen? Well, because all the pieces were primed, he comes in, and it all fell into place. Mechanism complete. At the end of the third quarter, we go down to the Everglades. Everglades are a unique ecosystem on the planet. We're only 4 to 5 hours away. Might as well drive down camp there for a week and talk about ecology. I put this in here at this spot because that's where the bugs in the Everglades are not that bad. Okay, truth be told, It's kind of a beautiful time to go down, and if the water levels are low, you'll get to see a lot of great creatures. You can almost put this piece in wherever so that you can take the maximize the location God has you. You know what I'm saying? If the seasons are such that late fall is the time to be out in God's creation and studying all that, do it then. Figure you can weave those pieces together. It works. So now, fourth quarter, we get into all those things they did not understand in the 19th century. They didn't know what was going on inside cells. They didn't understand cell processes. They didn't understand genetics. They didn't understand why offspring looked like their parents. So we talk about, these are more of those effects. This is what is happening. This is what's happening in photosynthesis. This is what's happening in cell respiration. And I try to get a reasonable level of detail where they go, okay, this is complicated. But you don't have to make it uber complicated. I want them to feel it's complicated. Because when I get to this last piece, history of life, and asking what's the cause, say, all right, well, let's talk about the evolutionary story of life. Life came from non-life. Stop. Remember how DNA makes RNA, makes proteins, makes traits, but that requires proteins, which requires ATP, which requires proteins, which requires more DNA, and you start having all this interconnected, ooh, everything's interconnected. You're having all these interconnections between all the molecules happening inside a cell. How do you make that all at once? Or how do you build that in a sequence fashion? What causes that? There's nothing material does that. So is this a sufficient cause? And then we get to, life developed in an anaerobic environment, and then photosynthesis was created. Wait, stop. Let's think about that for a second, and they start going, and they start thinking back to photosystem 1 and photosystem 2 and electron transport chain and ATP synthase and the hydrogen ions going back and forth and NADP. Yeah, no, sorry. Not buying that. So I teach these parts. I got a laser. I teach these parts so that when we get to here, even if they don't remember all the details, they feel this is too complicated to come from just random molecules in motion. Okay? Mendel, this is a good story for you guys to research and to bring in. So you've got Mendel. Okay, there are these factors that are separate from the traits. And so what are those factors? There's a story about how those factors are DNA. Okay, and then DNA to RNA to protein to trait. Okay, that's great. But then we get to the Human Genome Project, where they're expecting to find 100 plus thousand genes, because we have at least that many proteins. No, we got about 20 some odd thousand. Whoa, this is way more complicated than we thought. And then it turns out we got a whole new discipline called epigenetics. Anyone know what the prefix epi means? On top of. There's got to be something on top of the DNA that's controlling things. DNA, RNA, protein, trait is great for making chairs. What organized the chairs in the room? DNA, RNA, protein, trait is great for making musical notes. Who organizes that into a symphony? This is all the rage. They're trying to figure this out. Is it methylation of DNA? Is it cytoskeletal structure? Is it, I don't know, they're still trying to figure this out. All within material language. But what do we find when we talk about DNA itself? We find information. And what is information? It's a combination of both material and immaterial. What do we mean when we talk about cell processes? As though non-living things were acting with purpose? I mean, isn't that how we talk about it? All right, the electron goes from here, and it does this, and then this molecule does this. And wait. Do these molecules intend to do it? It's how we say it. Oh, no, it's all random. We certainly don't talk about it that way. So even within cells, it seems like non-living things, we've just called them non-living, they're acting with purpose. We're bumping right up against formal and final cause again. So why do I keep pushing on this formal and final cause business? How many of you were in Steve Turley's talk? A couple of you? Okay. Well, we know this. If the world, if reality is just atoms and molecules passively being bounced around, we have no meaning or purpose. Right? If all a tree is a complex-celled multicellular autotroph, or eukaryotic multicellular autotroph, what meaning is there? What do we read all these stories for? It's all about meaning. It's all about purpose. It's all about shaping loves and desires. But if we come along in science class and say, oh, no, but in reality, it's like this, wham, we have just completely undercut our whole humanities department and everything we're about here. If we provide language the way we were taught that, oh, these things are nothing but material and efficient causes in motion, if we speak that way, that undercuts what's happening in the rest of the school. We have to be careful. This is why we have to be building bridges to the humanities department. And we have to think about how we say things. One key thing what's this top part of our brain called? The cerebrum, right? So you're all using your cerebrum. I'm using my cerebrum. Is my cerebrum thinking? Or am I using my cerebrum to think? Did my cerebrum decide to move my arm? Or did I use my cerebrum to move my arm? Do you hear the vast difference between the way we say that? You say the former, you're undercutting the humanities department. Because it's just stuff. There's no meaning there. You start saying, I use my cerebrum. Now we're getting into the mechanics of how things work. But it's not negating where there's meaning and there's purpose. So we have to think very carefully about how we say and do these things. I just like dropped a bomb on you or something like that. So what are you guys thinking right now? We have about 15 minutes left. What I want to do is try to model for you how I talk about this worldview shift. I do it through art, and this ties into our history teacher who's also an art teacher. So we have great connection that way. But are there any questions that are just jumping out? Yes? No, but I have read a book by Turner. I think it's called Purpose and Desire. And he's basically saying, look, purpose and desire are real things. And so he's trying to get away from a genes-only model of looking at life. But it's still a materialist way, still a materialist view, where he's trying to combine sensors and what's happening inside and what's happening outside, and there's this interplay, and this is what we're calling desire and purpose. That's the closest I've read to what you're asking about.
My
statement isn't personal. Yeah. Am I anywhere close to anybody else thinking that? Well, yeah. It's like, what organizes these things? Either it's luck or there's something else. All right? So here's my final exam question. Matt Ehrlist, and I make these very polar. Christians don't understand that evolution accounts for everything in biology. Science and faith cannot coexist. Because Christians don't understand evolution, they do not care about the environment. Pat and Swa, Anyone know what I'm getting at by that name? The what? What are you laughing at? The pat answer. Simplistic. I want to guard my students against losing faith. There is no reason to lose your faith because of science. We may not have all the answers to things, but there is no reason to lose faith. But there are some simplistic answers out there that you need to guard against. Kind of like the evolutionist is stupid. Stop that. Stop. Okay? Evolution does not make any sense. Wait a minute. There's a logical form to the argument. It's not illogical. There is no evidence for it. Well, this is what they marshal in terms of evidence. Christianity has always opposed evolution. We have Christians today who believe God uses evolution as a mechanism. And this is where we of Christians have disagreement. But I have a whole host of parents and teachers, parents and students that I interact with. I've got them from all sides. Young Earth creationist, intelligent design, evolutionary creationist. I really could care less. And so my approach is to say, I'm not going to tell you what I think about it. Aside from God's the creator, and these are big, they're big complicated questions in here. Okay? So contribute to this on these topics. It's an hour and a half. This is our last week of preparation. So again, it's a synthetic question, and that helps me discern how much detail do I need to cover or not. Okay. So this narrative approach, macro to micro, provides a natural place for history and philosophy to come in. So this can be a straight-up biology class. With nothing about history and philosophy, you can teach it just straight macro, micro. And then as you learn history, philosophy, whatever, there's a natural place for it to go to. Does that make sense? So even if you don't know who René Descartes is, you could sequence it this way, and then when you learn about it, you can put it in place. Yeah. And this is where... what I explain to my students is that I have an Everest to climb for A's and a really broad, flat plane for B's and C's. And I don't have a point-by-point rubric that I use. It's really subjective. But honestly, everybody passes. And what they do on this test is remarkably close to what they do on their other tests, too. And I start reading, who are my A students? I read their papers first. If whatever my A students got, I can't imagine the B or C students are going to get more than that. And then I use that kind of as a guide. Oh, here's how much detail they put in. Here's the kind of synthesis this student did versus another. And that's when, as I'm reading it, I'm trying to discern kind of, this is great. Oh, we got some typo errors here, a little error here. And, some point deductions. And is there a difference between a 96 and 97 or 95? Not really. But then... And then when you reach your B students, there's like a level difference in terms of how they're talking about things in terms of detail or whatever. And then you know who your C students are. Sorry, it's probably not very helpful. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yep. Yes. No, I don't know. I would never spring this on them. I'm not a teacher about surprises. I say, here's the really high mountain, and I'm going to help you climb it. And there's always the panicky, and it's like, but then they reach the top, and they go, yeah, that was easy. I could do that. I've started the year with this question. Guys, that is your final exam question. This is what we're heading. All right. Narrative approach situates evolution in its historical context. You can provide a strong case for evolution, but say, look, we're just following the historical development. We're going to revisit this at the end, but for students to feel the weight of what was going on in the 19th century, of how it became our modern underpinning for all of biology. And you know what? A microevolution, microbiology to macrobiology approach kind of has a hidden evolutionary presupposition, doesn't it? Right? And so if you go macro to micro, you completely nix that out. Yeah. I just use whatever textbook I have. What I do with my students and with my parents, I explain to them my approach in a very shortened kind of fashion. Say, we're starting with the back of the book. Okay? And then we're going to go to animals and plants because we're going to go from concrete, because ninth graders are old middle schoolers. They're still pretty concrete in their thinking. And jumping into cell processes is really cruel. And yeah, don't worry. We'll get to the good stuff at the end. Yeah, and they're gone. But we're going to start with the human body. We're going to hook them that way. How do all these processes, how are they seen throughout the animal kingdom? We got plants. There's our first semester. Now, when we get to cell processes in the fourth quarter, their brains are as cooked as they can be as ninth graders. They're ready for more abstract, as ready as they can be as ninth graders. Obviously, if you have your flipped curriculum, if you have physics, chemistry, biology, okay, you're in a different place. These are all ninth graders I'm teaching. But this approach negates the whole hidden evolutionary assumption. Yep. I teach anatomy and physiology to 12th graders. Yep. Yeah, well, it's a human body for the whole year, so. Yeah, we go deeper, broader, all those kinds of things. Yep. Oh, right. So I have 7 minutes to go from the medieval worldview to the modern worldview. Okay? So there are four pieces of art that I use. One's called the Portinari Altarpiece, late 15th century. Okay? Now, when I do this in class, I put them in groups with huge pictures, black backgrounds, and get them to spend time looking at it. I have 7 minutes, and so there's just one key piece of information, two key pieces of information about this picture. Let's see if we can discern that. So, who's this? Mary. And so this would be baby Jesus. Okay? Who are these people here? Any ideas? This is actually the husband and wife who commissioned this piece. So these are living people. And then you've got living people in the background. And then these are saints in the background. Okay? And then we've got, who are these people with wings? Angels. What does this painting say about the material and the immaterial? They are all real. They are all interconnected. And what's more important? The immaterial, because they're bigger, right? And so you've got this all interconnected. The immaterial is greater. That is what is important that we should be striving for. Striving for virtue. Conforming to reality. Conforming our souls to reality as the wisdom of the past is. And then you have, I'll point out one piece here. This is a bundle of wheat. But notice how the bundle of wheat lies parallel to baby Jesus. What do we make out of wheat? Bread. Bread of life. Communion. Eucharist. Okay. So all the material world and all these flowers and colors all have symbolic meanings. So in the Middle Ages, when they are looking at creation, creation is a window to see the eternal truths of God. These flowers are not complex-celled, multicellular autotrophs. They are indicators of spiritual realities. They were asking very different questions than we were asked, than we are currently asking. Okay? But the physical world has symbolic meaning. That's what was important. Material and immaterial, all what? Interconnected. Move forward 100 years. Is the material world and the immaterial world connected or not? There's kind of a separation, right? You look at the tops of their heads, okay? All these living, this is a funeral, this Count Orgaz, he's dead. All these people are alive, it's a lot darker. Where you see light, these are the priests. This is Augustine and I can't remember the guy's name, but they have come down from heaven to actually bury him. And up here is where there's real life. Okay, there's all this color, all this white, all this living action. There's interconnection, but still some separation. Okay, I like this to show, is it connected or not? Well, kind of both. But it's definitely not what we had before. Okay? So let's fast forward 100 years. Christ's crown of thorns. So here's Jesus. And this is called a single light source painting, where there is one light source. And what is that light source? It's Christ. Jesus is the light source, right? Yes, you have a torch, but really, Jesus is the central light. And you have all different people with different relations to him. But the single light source is the key piece to this painting. Okay, for religious art in the 17th century, particularly Dutch, I think, single light source, very, very important. So now we fast forward 100 years. Experiment on a bird in an air pump. Okay? So let's spend the 2 minutes we have left looking at this. Here's our natural philosopher. Here's a parakeet. You've got the father, you've got his children pulling the shade or opening it, but there's no light from nature. You've got different people with different expressions. You've got the romantics who are completely disinterested. Okay? And this is an air pump. This is a device that sucks the air out of the chamber and then just to see what happens to what's inside. Okay? Now, if you notice that they have a bird cage that's empty and this is their house, what does that make this creature? Their pet! So dad says, yeah, daughters, we're going to put our pet into the air pump, and what is he asking? Is this bird going to live or die? Okay? Pointing, this is the future, right? And now we have, what's the light source? What's the light source? It's not Jesus anymore, it's what? It's science. So we have this transition of the interconnections of the material and the immaterial, the natural and the supernatural, all intimately interconnected, split apart. And now, science is what provides us truth. And you can put a piece of modern art next to it and say, yeah, now we got nothing. Okay? But as we walk through this, the big question here is this wonder or is this curiosity? And is there a real difference between them? Okay? Modern science, for curiosity's sake, will put your pet in an air pump. Wonder does not. Wonder is going to work with the flow and the form of nature. Nature has a nature, and we need to conform ourselves to it. I'm 1 minute over. I apologize. Anyway, thank you.